I'm Awa Asmani.
I'm Matt Ruiz.
And welcome to the You Belong in AI podcast presented by UCLA ACM AI Outreach. Today we will be interviewing Lachelle Hadley. Dr. Hadley is an associate professor of computer science at Coppin State University. She is also a faculty and residence fellow at Google and founding executive director of a nonprofit organization called Uplift. She is also a creator of Miles and Alicia, cartoon characters that are designed to aid students in learning STEM. On Rate My Professors, 100% of her students would take her classes again, and she was recently recognized as one of the 20 most influential technologists in Baltimore. In her free time, she enjoys cooking, hip-hop, updating her Instagram at I Am Rare and Beautiful, and Twitter at Lachelle, and more. Dr. Hadley, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me. Hello, everyone.
All right, so I guess, like, before we talk anything about what you're working on, like, nowadays, I kind of want to get to know a little bit more about your background or your education, you know, where you came from. So our first section is going to be kind of like going into that. So the first question I want to ask you is, what were you like growing up, and did you have any interests, like, academically, non-academically, STEM-wise or non-STEM-wise? You know, what were your interests growing up?
So I should say, when I was growing up, the acronym STEM didn't exist. So, I mean, computers were around, but they certainly weren't as emphasized as they are now. It was like a telephone, right? You had a computer, you had a phone, you had a TV, right? In terms of the everyday household. I'm from the generation, I'm from New Jersey. I'm from the generation that played outside. So I played outside all the time, riding bikes in the creek, making mud pies, kickball, four squares. My friends and I growing up, no matter which neighborhood I, you know, what time period in my life, you know, we all kind of beat the street signs, the street lights coming home. And we didn't want to leave then, but that was the kind of common rule to make sure you're safe and inside with your family and probably in time for dinner. So we played outside more than probably anybody nowadays does, especially during a pandemic. But academically, I don't say I was a nerd, but I was very smart, and I didn't hide it. But at that point, I think the connotation of a nerd was like this weird white boy with button up shirt and just, you know, high water pants. And so no one at the time said, you know, proudly said they were a nerd, right? Now I do, but then I was definitely intelligent, and I didn't hide it at all.
Yeah, it's great to hear. And yeah, we're all nerds at heart.
Yeah, exactly, right.
So I guess, like, leading into that, you know, like, what made you from there on decide to, like, study computer systems, you know, going to college? Like, what attracted you to that major, and, like, how confident were you going into that major at the time? And yeah, what also, like, what finally made you decide to apply to colleges?
So I always knew I wanted to go to Howard University, which is a HBCU in Washington, D.C. I mean, I applied to other institutions just because my basketball coach and my mom and my family wanted me to, but I got accepted into every college I applied to, but I knew I was going to Howard. And interestingly enough, I'm dyslexic. And at the time, it was paper applications, and you had to fill in a code for the major that you wanted. And I thought I was putting the code for animation, and I got the number switched. And I ended up in computer systems engineering. But I loved it, right? I got there and I was just like, wait, I wasn't thrown off because there were computers, right? But you know, when I started taking classes and they were talking about programming, I was like, what is this? This is not animation. But I loved it. I ended up staying there, and all my electives were in animation instead. So that's actually how it happened.
Love to hear I came back full circle, but yeah, that's a really
right, cool story. Exactly. Maybe we'll get there, right?
No, yeah. But I guess, like, another question is, like, as you're going to Howard, like, you know, how was it being like HBCU, and, like, did you also, like, face any, like, female, like, minority issues while you're there, or?
Not at all. I mean, I didn't have any women professors, but I guess it was so common that no one really paid attention to it until somebody did and was like, wait, yeah, you're right. But I didn't, it was home. It was a home away from home. It was finally being around all the other quote unquote nerds who were proud to be smart, but didn't want to call themselves nerd. And so I ended up being in a pre-engineering program. So it was the summer before freshman year where we spent 3 weeks on campus in computer system engineering is classes in mechanical engineering, electrical, and computer science, right? And physics. And so we got a head start. And I was voted most likely to succeed because I would have everybody walking around campus doing weird experiments like, let's see how, you know, let's drop a penny and see how far the, you know, the gutter is down beneath us, right? This is our free time and we're timers and pennies set and everybody was with me. So it was home. I never felt like I was unwanted in any way.
That's great to hear. I really love the response. And yeah, honestly, like, yeah, college nowadays, everyone's glued to their cell phones. Kind of makes me miss that those times or feel like I grew up in the wrong generation. But yeah, I love to hear that you had a great time.
Yeah, I had an awesome time.
So that wraps up the background education section. I'm going to pass it off to Ava now to talk about professional involvement.
Sure.
All right. Thanks so much for answering those questions. It was really, really interesting to get to know you, you know, get to know how you were, I guess, when you were younger and going through education, but I guess my next question is about your professional life. So currently you are an associate professor at Coppin State. So what made you decide to become one?
So it's interesting. While I was in grad school, like my last 2 years or so at George Mason, I also was employed by Howard University as a program manager for an NSF grant. And the NSF grant was designed to work with all the women STEM faculty at Howard University. And most people assume that all the professors at HBCUs are Black, but they're not. They're Asian, they're white, they're all, whoever wants to teach, right? But this grant was designed to kind of focus on their challenges, their successes, their leadership training, you know, what their lived experiences are like as women STEM faculty. So HBCUs, if you didn't know, are the greatest producers of STEM majors with undergraduates across the country. They produce more than half of the African-American STEM workforce. And so there's something there, right, that's happening at HBCUs to enable the success. And so we wanted to kind of understand what was happening as it relates to that, as well as just the lived experiences. So here I am, 2 years at least working on this project, and every day I'm talking to professors. And, you know, I think I coordinated a writing retreat at one point, and it was like a 4-day retreat. And, you know, we write all day, and at night we just relax, right? We're in the playing pool, playing games. And of course, no one wants to go to bed. So I think I asked him, well, you know, of all the challenges that you all express, why do you want to be a professor? Like what makes you keep coming back? And they just laid out a long list of major benefits, right? Aside from impacting young lives, right? They were like, the schedule is great. You get summers off, you get Christmas break. You get to research about whatever you want and you don't need to ask for permission. I think one faculty member said, if I wanted to start studying basket weaving, I can. And no one have it's academic freedom. No one has the right to say, no, Dr. Hatley, you can't study basket weaving. And I felt like that was amazing. One, it gave me a chance, or I guess later as I applied to become a professor, it made me realize that, you know, all those dreams, wanting to do my animation, my learning technology, my culturally relevant pedagogy research, becoming a professor was like the place to do it. It just made total sense. And so I don't necessarily think at that point, at that writing retreat, that I made up in my mind that I wanted to be a professor, but it was looking pretty good, right? and it just so happened, this was, I've been at Coppin about 5 years now. it just so happened that I was also working on another project with some companies in Baltimore to build a wearable device. So right now I know everything there is to know about where to get parts, right? For electronics, how to put them together, just based on my experience. And so I was working with a company that was trying to make a wearable health device for diabetes patients. And there was a group of students who were also working on the project. And because of my teaching experience, I was responsible for making sure that they knew everything they needed to do to be able to contribute to this project. And it just so happened that one of the students on this project also went to Coppin State. And he found out that they had an opening, and he went and told the department chair, hey, if you're gonna hire anybody, you need to hire LaShelle Hadley, contact her on LinkedIn. And that's exactly what the department chair did. I interviewed and been there for 5 years. So that is the, you know, when I heard about the opportunity, all those conversations about the amazingness of being a professor, just everything just started clicking. And I was like, okay, yeah, I'm gonna apply. I'm gonna interview. And the rest is history, as they say.
That's great, actually. I think that's interesting.
See, you should be a professor. You see how convincing that is? Summer's resolve, Christmas break.
Yeah.
You don't work 9 to 5, right?
You just work. Exactly. Yeah, and then you get to do research,
right? Like, it's the best job.
Yeah, exactly.
And you get to teach people in Impact Lodge, right?
So, right, yeah.
Yeah.
You got to throw that in there.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Yeah. So you have so many amazing publications, but one that especially piqued my interest and Matt's interest was your chapter in cultural learning and technology. So what exactly is culturally responsive teaching, and why is it important?
Sure. That chapter was actually the pilot study for my dissertation study. So that was like, when you do a pilot, you want to make sure that everything you plan to do in the quote unquote real study doesn't go wrong. So it's kind of like the practice run. But that was, it taught us so many things that we just thought we would publish it. So the co-author on that is Kevin Clark, who is my PhD advisor, and another mentor of mine who is a professor at Howard, Cynthia Winston Proctor. And so the third author is Gina Page, and she is the founder of African Ancestry. And African Ancestry is a DNA company, sort of like Ancestry.com, but they take your DNA and they can tell you not only like what country or continent you're from, but also which tribe in Africa you're from. And so, you know, I'm sure you know the history of the enslaved Africans in this country, how that kind of robbed us of everything, right? And I could go down the list, but the result of it is that we don't really know where we're from, right? And enslaved Africans were sold, they were traded, so families were broken up. And so it's really hard to kind of trace your ancestry back to, you know, hundreds of years ago. So that is the uniqueness of her product. And she was a part of that project because really, in order for you to kind of do well in any endeavor, whether it be computer science or basket weaving, you kind of have to have some self-confidence at the very least. And then figure out what motivates you. And then what do you see yourself as a basket weaver, right? And you know what, you might come from a long line of basket weavers, right? And so trying to understand who you are was a big part of that pilot. And that is the essence of culturally relevant pedagogy. Not only am I going as an educator going to respect you as a human being in the classroom, but I'm also going to honor who you are in the culture you came from. Doing that will hopefully engage you and motivate you more in learning, especially when it gets hard, right? And you want to give up. If I can tell you, if you're in a statistics class and I can tell you that W.E.B. Du Bois actually created some of the statistical charts that we use nowadays, that might kind of pique your interest just a little bit more than learning about somebody who, you know, you probably can't even remember their name, right? So culturally relevant pedagogy is really, really, really important. And not just for African-American students, for everybody, right? Because your culture is kind of in your DNA, it's in your blood. And if I can tap into that, I can certainly educate you, teach you anything at that point if I make it relevant.
Got it. Yeah, very interesting. And definitely a teaching style that I think more people should adopt.
It makes sense, right? It's just good pedagogy, right? It is really. But it's hard because if I say, for instance, you know, I grew up in an African-American neighborhood most of my life. I went to HBCUs. I taught at HBCU. Imagine if I go to Japan and I become a professor and I start teaching based on what I know. They will look at me like, who? We don't know what, we can't relate, right? So the onus is on me to understand their norms, their culture, you know, what's the level of respect? What do different things mean? Even if it's just body language, so that I can more effectively teach them, right? So again, cultural relevancy is for everybody. We're all different and we're, you know, no student is the same. And so every educator should certainly honor that.
Yeah. I agree. Yeah, definitely.
So you really want to be a professor now?
Oh yeah, definitely. I'm learning so much now. I'm just going to go read all your other
books. Both of you, right? All right, cool. You need anything, you need any assistance, advice, just let me know.
Oh, thanks. I really appreciate that. Thank you. So pivoting a little bit away from publications and research. So I've heard from a good friend of mine who's also in ACMAI. Their name is Arjun, about a certain presentation you gave back when you were an intern at Google about being Black in software engineering. Can you tell me more about your presentation and about what you said?
Oh, wow. Okay. So that was an interesting time. Okay. So here we go. All right. It's another long story, but it's a good one. So as a professor of computer science, you know, I don't know if you know the statistics, but in tech companies, especially, the number of anybody other than white male, the percentages are extremely low. For Black students, I don't care what gender, the hiring rate is in the low double digits. So I'm talking like 10% or less at your Googles, your Facebooks, your Twitters. And as computer science faculty from a number of HBCUs across the country. By the way, there are about 103 HBCUs, about 85 of them have computer science departments. So it was incumbent upon us to figure out our students, they use these products, they want to work for these companies, but they were not getting interviews. And if they were getting interviews, they weren't being hired. And so we were trying to figure out how can we improve these outcomes. And we worked with some people at Google to figure out, you know, what's happening with the interview process. You know, we wanted them to just accept the students, you know, bypass the interview altogether, right? If you're trying to increase your numbers, just hire them. Who cares about the interview process? But they didn't agree to that. So we said, okay, well, let's crack open this interview. What's happening in your interview process? What do you expect students to know? What's happening during the hour, 2 hour interview? And so that actually led to an opportunity, and Google calls it faculty in residence. So I was a part of the team that kind of helped create this idea, and also the first inaugural group of faculty members who went to the mothership of Google headquarters in California, Mountain View. And we spent 6 weeks there as software engineers. There were about 31 faculty from about 25 HBCUs. And so Google rolled out the red carpet. They paid for our housing. We got to ride the Google buses back and forth to work. If you live close enough, you got to rent a Google bike, or you don't rent it, it's free, right? All expense paid, you go come here and do two things. One, understand what it's like to be a software engineer at Google from the interview process forward. And two, what it's like to, what do they expect students to know and how can we adapt our curriculum to fit that? And so we spent 6 weeks at Google. It was a very interesting process. So Google, if you don't know, their IDs are color coded in such a way where, you know who works where, you know who works in the kitchen, you know who works in legal, you know who works as a software engineer. And interestingly enough, there are not a lot of people on Google's campus that have brown skin. And certainly not a lot of people who are walking around with software engineering badges. So at first, we went there, and it takes a while to get your badges made. And so there was this group of, you know, brown skinned people walking around in groups. How dare they? Who are they? Where are they from? So we didn't have our badges yet. So they said, you know, we had to actually get a rush order to get our badges so we can be identified as software engineers. That made it worse. Like, who are these software engineers walking around campus, and how dare they, right? I mean, I say that because several of my colleagues were stopped and said, you know, where are you going? Why are you, you know, you have free reign in the campus. If you want to go to a cafeteria for lunch that's serving Chinese food, you got to go that way. Like, you had to run to the campus, and they welcomed us as a regular employee. Well, unfortunately, several of Google employees didn't appreciate that. And they would stop some people, like, do you belong here? Next time, go around. And it was some really interesting treatment. And we actually got visited by some very high ranking employees at Google, vice presidents, about what we were experiencing. Because I think, one, they were embarrassed. Two, they didn't realize it was that bad, right? Like, they just didn't realize that somebody with brown skin would get treated like that. And so they were coming to us to figure out what we thought should happen next. So at almost every turn, it was a reminder that we stuck out like a sore thumb. I mean, Google has Google Rideshare. Not sure if that's, can't remember if that's exactly what they call it, but it's like Uber. And we wanted to go across campus. We had some people who, you know, if you didn't feel like riding a bike or walking, you just called the car. And we got in the car one day, and the driver was like, oh my God, why are you guys here? I've never picked up Black people, and definitely not more than one in a group, right? And this, here it is, 10 of you guys. Like, why are you here? And when we told him who we were, that flabbergasted him even more. He was so happy to hear that there were computer scientists who were Black on campus. So it was that bad. So again, I didn't feel like I was there to solve their racism issue. And I frankly was ready to go. I wanted to go back home. Like, I can figure this out on my own. We can come back another time. And my colleagues said, Lachelle, this is the civil rights struggle of our time, right? They told me, you know, Martin Luther King, I'm sure he wanted to just preach on Sunday in his pulpit every Sunday, go home with his family and chill out too. But he, you know, mounted this amazing fight that probably helped to get, you know, amazing civil rights in this country. And so I was like, all right, okay, you got me there. I will stay. I will try to do as much as I can. That experience made us design this on our last day, design this. Okay, you've told us what Google is like. Let us share with you what it's like at an HBCU, what our students are like, et cetera. And they thought it was a great idea. They telecast it to every Google location that exists on the planet. We have people calling in. And what we didn't realize, it was a great event, right? But what we didn't realize is there was a gentleman in the back who we thought was supportive, but it turns out he was the author of the Google Manifesto. I don't know if you heard about that. You're shaking your head. Have you heard about the Google Manifesto? It's a multi-page document. Look it up. Basically, he claims that only white males are good at programming, and everyone else, women, any other racial ethnicity, whatever, they don't belong at Google, and they certainly don't belong as a software engineer. He published that the following Monday. So he was at our event. probably upset that for 6 weeks he had seen these majority African-American people walking around as software engineers, came to our event on a Friday, and that Monday he released the Google manifesto. So for me, that let me know that not only do we have to prepare our students to be computer scientists, we need to prepare them for the people who don't want them to be computer scientists, who they will most likely be sitting next to at the lunch counter, or their cubicle is right next to. So it broadened our perspective as faculty members there to say, not only do we have to teach them algorithms, we got to teach them how to fight, right? Not physically, but just how to persevere through outcomes or challenges rather. So that particular presentation that you're talking about, that paper, really encouraged everybody who participated. It was a panel actually at a conference, and it encouraged us to really drive home, not only do you need to be the best that you can possibly be, if not 2 and 3 times better as it relates to algorithms and data structures and programming, no matter what programming language of choice, but we really wanted everybody in the audience to understand, if you're an ally, great. If you're not of color, you need to still know what's going on so you can stand on the right side of history. And if you are a person of color, you need to understand, yes, you have a passion for computer science. Yes, you could do it. But if you get a degree and you get hired, please realize that you also have to persevere through these other challenges that aren't necessarily spoken of, right? So we went through interviews in that panel. We went through data structures. We went through what it's like to work there on a team. I actually worked on the Android team. But we also talked about these other things that students don't typically think happens at a company like Google. So told you it was a long story, but I hope you agree that it was a good one. Yeah.
That's a great story. And really shocking, honestly.
Yeah, so. Right. And they're still going through problems, right, as it relates to their numbers, both from a gender perspective, as well as a cultural or ethnic perspective or race perspective. And so who knows what Google is going to do. I was supported by Google in my grad school at University of Maryland, especially. I am a Google baby. I love the company, but I also acknowledge that they have some challenges, and I'm still considered a faculty and resident. I still meet with them monthly, other faculty from, they've expanded it to Hispanic serving institutions. So each year since, this was in 2017, each year since they've had a cohort, and I think they're gonna have a virtual one this summer. I'm still in support of them, but they have a long way to go. And I'm hoping that they and companies like them, right? They're not alone. So I commend them for trying at least. And I think they're making headway, but we'll see, right? The data will show.
Right, exactly. Well, thank you so much for telling us about that. And so now we are going to be going to a new segment of our podcast, and Matt is gonna explain what it is.
Yeah, it's kind of a lighthearted segment. It's called 10 Epochs. So 10 lighthearted questions, just rapid fire. Pass if you need to, or just like, yeah, they're not supposed to be serious, but yeah. So this is 10 Epochs, 10 rapid questions. So let's begin with the first one. What is your favorite programming language?
Python.
TensorFlow or PyTorch?
TensorFlow.
Cool. What is your favorite hobby to do before the pandemic?
Hang out with my friends.
What is your favorite computer science class you've taken?
That I've taken? Wow, I haven't taken a computer class in so long. I think when I learned how to build an app myself. It was a class at University of Maryland. Yep.
Then what is your favorite computer science class to teach?
Programming. That's all I teach, actually. I teach Java, Python, and web programming. Right now, my advanced web programming class is my favorite.
Cool. Then when was a time where you felt the most fulfilled in your career?
When Miles and Aisha hit the Google store, App Store. And at the time it was called Android Market. It's called the Android Market before it was the Google App Store. When that hit the market, that was amazing, because that's why I wanted to learn how to build an app. And so the Miles and Aisha Black Inventors Match Game. So it was, it's still available, although on iOS, their recent update crashed it. So I'm trying to fix that. But it's a match game, like concentration. You turn the cards over and you match. But all the illustrations are pictures of items that African-Americans invented or got the patent, gotten patents for. So that was like the most proud moment in my life right now. Anything with Miles and Aisha is making me proud.
Okay, then what is the coolest research project you've seen in 2020? It doesn't have to be yours, it could be anyone else's.
Oh my goodness. Coolest research project. Definitely anything with robotics. As so many are coming to mind. Wow. So I can't remember his name. I think it's Moby, I believe. It's a miniature robotic blue robot for kids to help them. Just with anything, but emotional support, I think, is the most important. I think I got the name right, but that's my favorite project right now.
Cool. Then what is the fit? Who is someone in the AI community you admire the most?
Let's see. Ayanna Howard right now. She used to be a professor at Georgia Tech. She's about to be the dean at The Ohio State. I don't know why they say D, but I'll respect them. The Ohio State, she's about to be dean. She does AI and robotics. Her work is amazing. She just recently published a book. So definitely check it out. Ayanna Howard.
And I know you're dedicated to research, but if you could choose, what's one company that you'd work for?
Wow. I have to say Google, although it would not be as a software engineer. Yeah. It might be as their outreach and computer science education.
Awesome. Yeah. Then lastly, what is the company that you've worked at before? Like which has been your favorite company to work at so far?
I've been, let's see. I would say my own. My own company has been my favorite.
I love that.
Uplift and the other companies, Imagine.
Cool. Awesome. So that's the end of the segment. Thanks for answering those questions. Then we'll move on to educating profession. So this segment is all about like your teaching, your passion for teaching, which I thought was really interesting when I learned about you. So we'll start off with the first one. It's kind of vague, but I think it's a beautiful question. You know, like, why do you teach? You know, what's so beautiful about teaching, you know, seeing your students grow? And do you see it as like an art form? And like, what makes it so special?
I definitely see it as an art form. I've had a way with kids since I was a kid. I literally had this older woman, one of my elders in the community, tell me that I will do something special with kids since I was like six. And so every kid, I get it from my mom probably, but every kid is always drawn to me. My colleagues and those around me, my peers say I speak kid. So I think it's just always been something a part of me. I don't know life without wanting to help or teach. It's special because, especially in computer science nowadays and on the undergraduate level, I can help a student change their life to the point where they can graduate and get a job that can put them in another socioeconomic status. You know, I have a student right now who is from Nigeria. He wanted to be an electrical engineer to help bring electricity to his community. And now he's about to get a job making $130,000 a year. He probably never imagined that his freshman year. I asked him if he wanted to go back to be an electrical engineer. He said no. So just the impact of changing someone's life, that you have the power and the responsibility to do that, is amazingly special. And that's why I do it. I don't know anything else.
Then, okay, going on to my next question. Sure. What makes for a great computer science or technology educator? Like, especially an educator for artificial intelligence, like what makes for a good teacher?
You have to be willing to say you don't know. You have to be willing to roll up your sleeves and say, all right, even though I don't know exactly, we'll figure it out together. And I especially empower my students. So I don't only engage them, but I empower them to say, if you want to figure something out and I'm not giving you the answer that's satisfying, the internet is your oyster, right? Like, just go find a tutorial. Don't be scared. If that tutorial isn't effective, find another one and don't give up, right? And if you have the idea to seek out a solution, then the solution is there. You just have to find it. So be persistent. So I don't always have the answers to all their questions. I'm just learning. I just started AI research myself since I've joined Coppin. So I don't have all the answers, and I'm not afraid to say that I don't. But I am readily willing to roll my sleeves up and figure it out. And so you have to do that as a computer science educator, aside from being culturally relevant and all those other things we talked about. So yeah, that's definitely helpful, I think.
Yeah, honestly, coming from a student, like hearing that, you know, whenever a teacher is like, I don't know the answer, it honestly brings me closer to the teacher. Just feels like we're in the same boat, you know, we're trying to figure it out together. So I think that's a great answer. So
yeah. And don't you want to be the one who told the teacher,
exactly, right?
Like,
yeah.
Look what I told her that, yeah. Right? Yeah. Certainly.
Just it motivates you even more to figure out the solution as well.
Exactly. Exactly.
So that wraps up the section about education in general. So I'm going to pass it off to Ava for another interesting segment about the future representation in AI.
All right. So I think we've talked a lot about, representation in computer science. So just to get some more like information on what you think about it. So artificial intelligence is becoming a dominant form of technology in the industry. Why do you think it's important that we ensure that people of all backgrounds learn to engineer AI?
Oh, wow. So just because we have racist people, we have racist software engineers, which I shared about, and they're the ones who are making the products. And so their biases, their ways of thinking are inherently built in the products that they create and design. For instance, I don't know if you probably experienced this. You went to the bathroom where the faucets are automatic and you put your hand under and you kind of got to do like this and do like that again and do like that a third time. Well, the company that built that never tested it on people with brown skin. So only people with white skin, when they put their hand under, no problem. Coppin actually had those faucets and had to take them all out because they didn't work for anybody, which is expensive, right? So we need to be in the room when products are created, just because we have perspectives that they don't, and vice versa, right? So and we can figure out or help, you know, a flag will raise and say, hey, wait, this didn't work for me, so something's wrong, or along those lines. We need to be in the room. So a lot of people, I think, I don't know if you all remember this, you probably weren't even born when this debate was around, but if you go around any city block, you see the ramps on the corners, right? I was alive when it was a debate about whether or not those ramps should be there. And the original reason was because of people who were in wheelchairs. They wanted to be able to travel just like everybody else, but they couldn't because they had to get up on the curb. And so, of course, they want, you know, that debate was in favor of the ramps, but we all benefit from them. So much so that you probably didn't even know that they came from, you know, they were made because of people with wheelchairs. But we all benefit from them, whether we're on bikes, whether we're on skateboards, it doesn't matter. They're leveraged and they're useful. And so I take that same perspective from AI. You know, you have to be able to pinpoint the ways in which it's impacting special populations. But once you do that, it's not going to hurt anybody. As a matter of fact, it'll probably benefit everyone in ways in which you didn't even think were possible. So I hope that answers the question.
No, that definitely does. And that's a great answer.
Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode of You Belong in AI. This episode was made possible by UCLA ACM AI Outreach. Again, my name is Matt Ruiz, and I co-hosted today with Ava Osmani and our great guest, Dr. LaShelle Hadley, an associate professor of computer science at Coppin State University. This episode was edited by Kai Tota and Jason Jewick, and the music was by Kevin McLeod, and is called Cheery Monday.
You belong in AI, even if someone tells you you don't.
I love that.